Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Coach Karen Scott. Thank you for joining, and I'm hoping you can hear me because I'm having a little bit of issues, but I do believe I should be okay now. Just thanking everybody for joining, and we'll be starting very shortly. Okay, everyone, welcome to Blog Talk Radio with your host, Coach Karen Scott. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us here on the show tonight. As always, a lot of impactful information in our book club read. As you know, I will be sharing a health tip or tips with us tonight, or with you tonight, before we start a book club read. So you still have time to invite someone on the show. It's not a secret, but it is nice to be able to share with other people the things we are learning on the show. Now, last week we talked about raw vegetables versus cooked. So I'm just going to take it a step further and give you an idea as to what each of these particular vegetables do and how they can help us on the health tip. When you're eating green leafy vegetables, they pack a micronutrient punch. And these vegetables include dark lettuce, kale, collard greens, arugula, and watercress. Then you have the non-leafy cruciferous vegetables, which are broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, and radishes. They contain phytochemicals, which help modify your hormones, detoxify compounds, and prevent toxins from damaging DNA. Berries. They support heart health. They improve blood glucose levels and reduce inflammation. So enjoy all berries, including blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, and blackberries. Then we have beans. Satisfying and versatile, beans and legumes contain high levels of soluble and insoluble fiber and resistant starch. Mushrooms, white button, portobello, shiitake, oyster, and other varieties help protect against respiratory infections and breast cancer. Onions, leeks, scallions, and garlic supply anti-cancer, anti-inflammatory, and antioxidant compounds. Nuts, such as walnuts, pistachios, pine nuts, and almonds, are rich in stanols, fiber, minerals, and other health-promoting nutrients, and they protect against heart disease. Seeds provide all of the advantages of nuts, plus several provide omega-3 fats, flax seed, chia seeds, and hemp seeds. And they're also anti-cancerous, flax seed, chia seeds, and sesame seeds. Tomatoes, they are high in carotenoid lycopene. They have a strong antioxidant and anti-inflammatory property that help to protect against cancer and cardiovascular disease. And lastly, pomegranates and cherries. These fruits protect against heart disease, cancer, cognitive impairment, and reduce oxidative stress. So there are some of the best fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds that can help us with longevity for our health. And they're also, you know, great cancer-fighting foods as well. Because what I've been learning, I think I mentioned it before, that cancer cells look for sugar. And then that's where they begin to cause trouble. So we want to make sure that we're staying away from processed foods, foods with ingredients that you can't pronounce. It's very important to go farm to table if you can. Just be sure that you know what you're putting in your body's. So those are the tips for health tonight. We're going to keep it moving because, as you know, we were talking about the case for Christ, and we're in the introductory, and we know that the introductory is talking about this individual who was found guilty of something that he really didn't do. So now they have to open up the case, and now what does that mean? And this is when it takes us into the next part of the introduction. And just remember, pay attention to the introduction because it will parallel with The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel. New facts for a new theory. At the same time, I started my own investigation, studying the crime scene, interviewing witnesses, talking with Dixon, and examining the physical evidence. As I thoroughly checked out the case, the strangest thing happened. All the new facts that I uncovered and even the old evidence that had once pointed so convincingly toward Dixon's guilt snugly fit the pen gun theory. Now remember, Dixon is the one who was accused of shooting the policeman Scanlon. And prior to what I'm reading, we were talking about this pen gun that Scanlon had that's illegal, which is why he failed to mention that to anyone. So let's proceed on and see what's happening here. Witnesses said that before Scanlon arrived on the scene, Dixon had been pounding his gun on the door of his girlfriend's house. The gun discharged in a downward direction. In the cement of the front porch, there was a chip that was consistent with a bullet's impact. This would account for the bullet that was missing from Dixon's gun. Dixon said he didn't want to be caught with a gun, so he hid it in some grass across the street before the police arrived. And I found a witness who corroborated that. This explained why the gun had been found some distance from the shooting scene, even though nobody had ever seen Dixon throw it. There were powder burns concentrated inside, but not above. The left pocket of Scanlon's shirt. The bullet hole was at the bottom of the pocket. Conclusion, a weapon had somehow discharged in the pocket's interior. Contrary to statements in the police report, the bullet's trajectory had been at a downward angle. Below Scanlon's shirt pocket was a bloody rip where the bullet had exited after going through some flesh. Dixon's rap sheet hadn't told the whole story about him. Although he had spent 3 years in prison for an earlier shooting, the appellate court had freed him after determining that he had been wrongly convicted. Keep that in the back of your mind. It turns out that police had concealed a key defense witness and that a prosecution witness had lied. So much for Dixon's record of violent tendencies. This is why we have to always research and look into things further. An innocent man is free. Finally, I put the crucial question to Dixon. If you are innocent, why in the world did you plead guilty? Dixon sighed. It was a plea bargain, he said, referring to the practice in which prosecutors recommend a reduced sentence if a defendant pleads guilty and thus saves everybody the time and expense of a trial. They said if I pleaded guilty, they would sentence me to 1 year in prison. I'd already spent 362 days in jail waiting for my trial. All I had to do was admit that I did it, and I'd go home in a few days. But if I insisted on a trial and the jury found me guilty, well, they'd throw the book at me. They'd give me 20 years for shooting a cop. It wasn't worth the gamble. I wanted to go home. And so, I said, you admitted to doing something that you didn't do. Dixon nodded. That's right. In the end, Dixon was exonerated, and he later won a lawsuit against the police department. Scanlon was stripped of his medal, was indicted by a grand jury, pleaded guilty to official misconduct, and was fired from the department. As for me, my stories were splashed across the front page. Much more important, I had learned some big lessons as a young reporter. One of the most obvious lessons was that evidence can be aligned to point in more than one direction. For example, there had been easily been enough proof to convict Dixon of shooting the sergeant. But the key questions were these: the collection of evidence really been thorough? And which explanation best fit the totality of the facts? Once the pen gun theory was offered, it became clear that this scenario accounted for the full body of evidence in the most optimal way. And there was another lesson. One reason the evidence originally looked so convincing to me was because it fit my preconceptions at the time. To me, Dixon was an obvious troublemaker, a failure, the unemployed product of a broken family. The cops were the good guys. Prosecutors didn't make mistakes. Looking through those lenses, all the original evidence seemed to fall neatly into place. Where there had been inconsistencies or gaps, I naively glossed them over. When police told me the case was airtight, I took them at their word and didn't delve much further. But when I changed those lenses, trading my biases for an attempt at objectivity, I saw the case in a whole new light. Finally, I allowed the evidence to lead me to the truth, regardless of whether it fit my original presuppositions. That was more than 20 years ago. My biggest lessons were yet to come. Think about what he just said about changing the lenses, looking at things in an objective way so that he can see clearly what was brought to light in this case, regardless of what he thought about this case in the past. Again, that was 20 years ago. Moving on, from Dixon to Jeebus. The reason I recounted this unusual case is because, in a way, my spiritual journey has been a lot like my experience with James Dixon. For much of my life, I was a skeptic. In fact, I considered myself an atheist. To me, there was far too much evidence that God was merely a product of wishful thinking, of ancient mythology, of primitive superstition. How could there be a loving God if he consigned people to hell just for not believing in him? How could miracles contravene the basic laws of nature? Didn't evolution satisfactorily explain how life originated? Doesn't scientific reasoning dispel belief in the supernatural? As for Jesus, didn't you know that he never claimed to be God? He was a revolutionary, a sage, an iconoclastic Jew. But God? No, that thought never occurred to him. I could point you to plenty of university professors who said so, and certainly they could be trusted, couldn't they? Let's face it, even a cursory examination of the evidence demonstrates convincingly that Jesus had only been a human being just like you and me, although with unusual gifts of kindness and wisdom. But that's all I ever really given the evidence. Let me try that again. But that's all I had ever really given the evidence, a cursory look. I had just read enough philosophy and history to find support for my skepticism. A fact here, a scientific theory there, a pithy quote, a clever argument. Sure, I could see some gaps and inconsistency, but I had a strong motivation to ignore them, a self-serving and immoral lifestyle that I would be compelled to abandon if I were ever to change my views and become a follower of Jesus. As far as I was concerned, the case was closed. There was enough proof for me to rest easy with the conclusion that the divinity of Jesus was nothing more than a fanciful invention of superstitious people. So I thought. Answers for an atheist. I'm trying to get this book together. It wasn't a phone call from an informant that prompted me to re-examine the case of Christ. It was my wife. Leslie stunned me in the autumn of 1979 by announcing that she had become a Christian. I rolled my eyes and braced for the worst, feeling like the victim of a bait-and-switch scam. I had married one Leslie, the fun Leslie, the carefree Leslie, the risk-taking Leslie, and now I feared she was going to turn into some sort of sexually repressed prude who would trade our upwardly mobile lifestyle for all-night prayer vigils and volunteer work in grimy soup kitchens. Instead, I was pleasantly surprised, even fascinated, by the fundamental changes in her character, her integrity, and her personal confidence. Eventually, I wanted to get to the bottom of what was prompting these subtle but significant shifts in my wife's attitudes. So I launched an all-out investigation into the facts surrounding the case for Christianity. Setting aside my self-interest and prejudices as best I could, I read books, interviewed experts, asked questions, analyzed history, explored archaeology, studied ancient literature, and for the first time in my life, picked apart the Bible verse by verse. I plunged into the case with more vigor than with any story I ever pursued. I applied the training I had received at Yale Law School, as well as my experience as legal affairs editor of the Chicago Tribune. And over time, the evidence of the world, of history, of science, of philosophy, of psychology, began to point toward the unthinkable. It was like the James Dixon case revisited. That's why it's so important to read this introduction so that you can see the connection and the parallel between the two stories and how he was presenting his case. Judging for yourself. Maybe you too have been basing your spiritual outlook on the evidence you observed around you or gleaned long ago from books, college professors, family members, or friends. But is your conclusion really the best possible explanation for the evidence? If you were to dig deeper to confront your preconceptions and systematically seek out proof, what would you find? That's what this book is about. In fact, I'm going to retrace and expand upon the spiritual journey I took for nearly 2 years. I'll take you along as I interview 13 leading scholars and authorities who have impeccable academic credentials. I have crisscrossed the country from Minnesota to Georgia, from Virginia to California, to elicit their expert opinions, to challenge them with the objections I had when I was a skeptic, to force them to defend their positions with solid data and cogent arguments, and to test them with the very questions that you might ask if given the opportunity. In this quest for the truth, I've used my experience as a legal affairs journalist to look at numerous categories of proof: eyewitness evidence, documentary evidence, corroborating evidence, rebuttal evidence, scientific evidence, psychological evidence, circumstantial evidence, and yes, even fingerprint evidence. That sounds intriguing, doesn't it? These are the same classifications that you would encounter in a courtroom. And maybe taking a legal perspective is the best way to envision this process with you in the role as juror. If you were selected for a jury in a real trial, you will be asked to affirm up front that you haven't formed any preconceptions about the case. You would be required to vow that you would be open-minded and fair, drawing your conclusions based on the weight of the facts and not on your whims or prejudice. You would be urged to thoughtfully consider the credibility of the witnesses, carefully sift the testimony, and rigorously subject the evidence to your common sense and logic. I'm asking you to do the same thing while reading this book. Ultimately, it's the responsibility of jurors to reach a verdict. That doesn't mean they have 100% certainty, because we can't have absolute proof about anything in life. In a trial, Jurors are asked to weigh the evidence and come to the best possible conclusion. In other words, harking back to the James Dixon case, which scenario fits the facts most snugly? That's your task. I hope you take it seriously, because there may be more than just idle curiosity hanging in the balance. If Jesus is to be believed, and I realize that may be a big if for you at this point, then nothing is more important than how you respond to him. But who was he really? Who did he claim to be? And is there any credible evidence to back up his assertions? That's what we'll seek to determine as we board a flight for Denver to conduct our first interview. So we will proceed on to examining the record, God willing, on next week's show. I'm going to open up the call and just think about, like he said, the scenario of the James Dixon case, and how did you approach that as we were reading it, and how will you approach the case for Christ as we examine the evidence with the first interview next week. So I'm going to open it up. If there's any comments, the line is open.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you hear me? Oh. Well, first of all, with the veggies and the nuts and everything that you listed in the beginning, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so hungry right now. But I'm like, obviously I'm not hungry. It's just that I was like, all this sounds so good. And we eat that anyway, so it was nice to stuff that you already have been doing. So,
yeah.
You know?
Yes.
And plus, that's all God stuff. Like, you know, the earth is still providing what he set it out to do, so, and it's good stuff, so he wouldn't give you nasty stuff.
Yes, that's true, and it's a true blessing that we still can get, we still have access to these things.
Exactly, because everything, like whatever vegetable or fruit, the seeds and whatnot, as flowers too, they just reproduce themselves anyways, so.
You're right.
That's amazing.
That's how he. That's how he. Yep.
Yeah.
That's how he designed
it. And then for the book, two paragraphs that really stuck out that I got from it. It was towards the end. It's page 15 and then page 17. But this is what we do in life, anyways. You find facts based on what you want to believe, or your argument,
mm-hmm.
instead of the truth,
mm-hmm.
because the truth will beg you to dig deeper. And when he was an atheist, like he said, he found stuff that, you know, corroborated what he believed in, you know, quote here, so that was good enough. And then it's like, you know what, let me seek some stuff out. And then once you start seeking out truth, or, you know, you start digging deeper, I mean, you do that with a lot of things, like whatever you want to believe, or you're like, okay, well, that goes with what I want, so I don't need to hear anything else, or, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, opinion and
mm-hmm.
stuff, as long as, you know, a little thing here. But, yeah, so that was interesting to think about it
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, it is. It gives you, yeah, it makes you look at it from a different angle or a different perspective, like kind of like that quote we always hear about how people speak. You know, like you're listening with the intent to speak or
reply.
Comment before you even hear what the person is actually saying. So that's pretty much it for tonight. But like I said, we're just going to continue on with our journey.
Yeah, because questions get asked, like, after each chapter.
Yes. Yep. Questions get asked after each chapter. And I like how he kind of, like, brought you to the first
yeah.
chapter, which is examining
yeah.
the evidence by interviewing his first person. So that's going to be
uh-huh.
interesting to see, you know, where we're going to go with this and how, you know, how we conclude with it. So that's it for tonight. And thank you for joining
okay.
us. And as always, appreciate your support. And just enjoy the rest of your evening. And God willing, we will connect again on next Friday. Be blessed.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Good one. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You're welcome.